estado de inacción sobre lo que tiene que actuar y dejándose siempre controlar por los intereses de un Estado que ni siquiera podemos decir que ha pertenecido jamás a Naciones Unidas. Ha estado presente, pero no ha pertenecido, y me refiero a los Estados Unidos de América. ¿Por qué? Porque la pertenencia es algo más que estar aquí representado en el Consejo de Seguridad y en la Asamblea General. La pertenencia es compartir unos ideales y unos principios que Estados Unidos siempre ha luchado en contra. Nunca ha aceptado a Estados Unidos el imperio del derecho en las relaciones internacionales. Siempre han creído en la ley de la selva, es decir, el derecho del más fuerte. Estados Unidos habla de democracia y se opone a cualquier intento por democratizar esta institución, que es la peor de las dictaduras en todo el mundo. Por eso pronto estaremos nosotros también presentando una propuesta sobre la reinvención de las Naciones Unidas. Hace muchísima falta, y todo este drama que estamos viendo hoy, creo que más bien está ayudando, ojalá que así sea, una buena lectura, que esto esté ayudando a concientizar a la gente que las Naciones Unidas no puede seguir como está hoy en día.
Para escuchar la entrevista completa del expresidente de la Asamblea General de la ONU, el sacerdote nicaragüense Miguel Descoto, pueden visitar nuestra página blog en pueblossinfronteras.wordpress.com.
Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica. Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblossinfronteras@gmail.com.
Soñé Potosí, soñé Guanajuato, soñé Guatemala, soñé Panamá. Soñé palmeda, soñé locura, soñé del miedo, soñé saqueo.
Volvemos a Noticias de Honduras, donde este miércoles se realizó una movilización nacional en apoyo al magisterio. Entrevistamos a Miriam Miranda, coordinadora general de la organización fraternal negra hondureña.
Hay una crisis aquí en este país desde hace más o menos un mes. Los maestros iniciaron un proceso de lucha para exigir que se pudiera fortalecer la educación pública, porque el gobierno pretende privatizar la educación a través de la municipalización de la educación. Las municipalidades, generalmente cuando se les transfieren a ellos la administración de servicios públicos, como el tema del agua, el tema de la educación, el tema de la salud, automáticamente a las pocas semanas se están declarando incompetentes para administrar esos servicios, y las empresas privadas están listas para tomar el control de esos servicios públicos. En este sentido, la educación en el país está a punto de ser privatizada, y por eso es que tanto los maestros, que han sido muy reprimidos en las últimas semanas, ustedes saben de que han habido muertos. En el caso mío, por ejemplo, el día 29, todavía estoy adolorida porque fui reprimida, fui encarcelada a partir de las 7 de la mañana y también fui agredida con bombas lacrimógenas. Entonces, el movimiento popular está, todos los sectores de la sociedad civil nos hemos sumado a esta lucha justa de los maestros, de tal manera que el día de hoy, a partir de las 6 de la mañana, se decretó un paro nacional a nivel nacional, pero también un paro que con movilizaciones, con tomas de carreteras, con movilizaciones y acciones de las diversas comunidades, de los diversos movimientos sociales. Y en este momento hay mucha gente que ha sido reprimida. Sabemos de que hay gente que también ha sido encarcelada, pero el movimiento y el pueblo está realmente manifestándose y movilizándose por esta situación de la educación. Este es un paro en el que no se tiene tiempo definido, porque el gobierno insiste, el gobierno de Pepe Lobo insiste en no sentarse a dialogar con los maestros, y lo único que está haciendo es reprimiéndolos. Por lo tanto, las presiones que hay en este momento, donde paulatinamente se fue sumando el movimiento social, es para lograr de que el gobierno se pueda sentar y a dialogar y tomar una decisión, y se pueda avanzar en la resolución del conflicto, porque este gobierno insiste en no sentarse con los maestros. Entonces no hay un tiempo definido, hay acciones que de a partir de ahora a las 6 de la mañana nosotros estamos movilizándonos también para el encuentro de los 214 tambores el día de mañana como una conmemoración de las 214 años de presencia del pueblo garífuna en Honduras, que al mismo tiempo estaríamos sumándonos también en la capital a esta lucha.
¿Qué sector empresarial, financiero, qué organizaciones religiosas están detrás de la privatización o insisten en privatizar la educación?
Bueno, la verdad que son sectores empresariales que son los mismos que impulsaron el golpe de Estado. Ya se habla que incluso, por ejemplo, a las figuras, personas conocidas que estuvieron en el golpe de Estado, como la familia Tala, como la familia Facusé, están listos ya con sus empresas para poder hacerse cargo de lo que es la privatización, de lo que es la administración de la educación.
Acaban de escuchar a Miriam Miranda, coordinadora general de la organización Fraternal Negra Hondureña.
Que no te tapen los ojos, ojo con la corrupción y la incomprensión, la indiferencia y la delincuencia, que con frecuencia ninguno se encuentra en esta nación. Ponele mucha atención a esta canción de corazón. Es más lo bueno que aquí tenemos, más los que queremos, creemos en esta tierra. Es una bendición. Mira Honduras con otros ojos.
Representantes de 10 organizaciones de colombianos desplazados por la fuerza de sus comunidades cuestionaron la ley de víctimas y restitución de tierras que se debate en el Congreso de ese país. Advirtieron que no han sido consultadas sobre el texto del proyecto de ley y solicitaron participación y seguridad. Rigoberto Jiménez es el coordinador nacional de desplazados.
Los grupos paramilitares que el gobierno denomina bandas criminales van a seguir actuando en el papel que jugaron desde su creación. Van a ponerse al servicio de los intereses de terratenientes, paramilitares, empresas transnacionales que quieren apoderarse de la tierra de los campesinos.
Alfonso Castillo, representante de la organización Tierra, Vida y Dignidad, afirmó que les preocupa el asesinato continuo y metódico por parte de grupos paramilitares de líderes que exigen la restitución de las tierras arrebatadas a sus comunidades. El líder de los desplazados recordó que en los últimos años han sido asesinados al menos 51 dirigentes que lideraban restituciones de tierra. El último fue Eder Berbel Rocha, asesinado el pasado 23 de marzo. Desde agosto del 2010, cuando Juan Manuel Santos asumió la presidencia de Colombia y anunció su plan de restitución de tierras, han sido asesinados 9 dirigentes campesinos, según cifras oficiales. Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a Workers Independent News de Estados Unidos, a Telesur y a la Red del Sur de Venezuela y a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it is Bathrop's Piers Broadsides with a number of special guests, including Diana and the infamous Ocean Newman, attorney of Berkeley, calling in from Berkeley, we hope, at 6:30 tonight. We are not broadcasting, of course. We're just streaming, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't stream along with us. So dive in and stay tuned.
As certain as the sun will rise and politicians have lying eyes, as sure as suffering multiplies, the rich will never be poor. As certain as in life you learn, the rich have money and time to burn, the rich will counsel you, wait your turn, in heaven you'll get some more. As sure as poverty plagues the land, the rich will give you a helping hand, as soon as mountains return to sand and oceans leave the shore. Count on nothing in life so well that if the rich go straight to hell, lots are something they buy and sell, they'll never enter the door. Clearly all that you need in life to be at peace in a world of strife, the company of a man or wife and lots of money in store.
Life is simple and so complete, with faithful friends and some bread to eat, a solid roof and a room with heat and stocks and bonds galore. The rich will probably tell you, nay, it's inner riches that really pay. The rich have always got lots to say as they watch their assets soar. Count on nothing in life so plain, the poor have water, the rich champagne. The market rises to this refrain: the rich will never be poor, the rich will never be poor. As sure as life is a strange affair, in need of some robust repair, the rich don't actually have to care, the rich will never be poor. Maybe people are all the same, but the rich are playing a different game. You take your chances and take your aim, you'll never even the score. The rich can't help it if life's unfair, the richer people, they really care. They often mention it's hard to bear, they're burdened at their core. Some say no, but it's plain to see, the rich are different than you and me. The rich are different as they can be. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor.
And is it the new theme song of the show, The Rich Will Never Be Poor, from the CD of the same name by Carol Denny? Well, maybe so. Generally speaking, although there are exceptions, The Rich Will Never Be Poor is, for me, it's where it's at. So, where you're at is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM generally, but unfortunately not today because we are still waiting to get that DSL connected to the transmitter so we can actually transmit. However, we are streaming on the stream, I believe. Let's double check here. Taking a look. Yeah, we are streaming. So those of you who have computers can hear us, and those of you who are patient enough or interested enough to listen to the archives, which can be found at huffsantacruz.org, huffsantacruz.org, can hear the show, and probably are listening. If you're listening to the live version, there is a call-in number here, 831-427-3772, 831-427-3772, and that's going to be available for the next half hour. After that, there'll be a second number, which I will read out as hopefully Osha Newman calls in to talk about the sitting ban coming up in Berkeley. Apparently, they're taking a very bad leaf from a bad book here in Santa Cruz and across the bay in San Francisco by again trying to make it a criminal offense to sit on the sidewalk near buildings during daylight hours. Santa Cruz, of course, has them one better beat, or beat by one better by having it illegal to sit 24 hours a day at any time of the day or night next to a building, whether occupied or vacant or closed, for that matter, in a business district. And within 14 feet, there are forbidden zones up and down every sidewalk in the city, in every business district and beachfront district. So that is how we deal with our undesirable problems in Santa Cruz. We don't let them sit down. You see, it's very simple. It works that way. Or let's put it this way. If a police officer comes along and sees a middle-class family seated on the sidewalk, well, it's one thing. But if they see some questionable individuals, like the woman we have in the studio with me, who is about to introduce herself, that's a little something different. What is your name, you ragamuffin, you?
My name is Diana Eagle.
Diana Eagle. What kind of a name is that? Are you a bird or a person?
Well, I'm a person, although I have been known to fly high sometimes. And I've been a mother for 40 years and a garbologist, which is someone who deals with garbage. And I was raised here in Santa Cruz for 26 years and recently got my master's.
And let me interrupt you, because I think you may not be going out on that questionable microphone, so I'm going to switch you around, hopefully to a better microphone. Let's try this one and see if you actually... get in here. See how this one goes. Let's try talking here and see how it goes.
Alrighty. How's that?
That's much better. Now you are. Now let's begin again. You're reading from a text here. I see that you've written up in some kind of scrawl next to a community notice about something, whatever. Your name is Diane or Diana Eagle?
Diana.
Diana Eagle. Okay, go ahead, Eagle.
Anyway, I've been a mother for 40 years and a garbologist, which is one who deals with garbage. For 30 years, was raised in Santa Cruz for 26 years, and recently received my Master Recycler certification, attending a local college class, and became an ordained minister. Now, that's all been said to qualify what I have to say here, which is that garbage has to be a thought, an idea in one's brain before it can be physically manifested. Now, the idea that living beings who have no address, house, home, etc., have no rights is not only a violation to our First Amendment right to life.
I would call it garbage myself. Go ahead.
Exactly. Which includes our First Amendment right, which includes sleeping. It also violates our moral laws, which are do unto others, help others, etc., and is part of the mind garbage idea.
Now, wait a minute. The mind garbage idea. What are you trying to give a positive sort of tilt to the word garbage? Or I'm not quite sure. Are you garbage something good, something bad, something mixed? What is garbage?
Garbage is things that are not required for our personal benefit. Things that are not useful. They cannot be.
So it's a negative term.
It's a very negative.
So we should say beforehand that, you know, you
it
actually...
It comes from ideas in people's heads. You can't have garbage physically of any kind until you have an idea in someone's head. That.
Oh, so what may normally be considered to be garbage might not be garbage at all? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that garbage has to start inside people. Like, it's an idea in someone's head.
I thought garbage was a bunch of stinky stuff in a can in the back of the house.
That's part of the garbage. Part of the garbage is our not allowing others to exist on this planet simply because they have no home, house, or dwelling space.
So, in other words, you're saying that certain ideas and attitudes are garbage? Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
exactly.
Normally, I mean, garbage usually refers to the debris or waste product of a bourgeois home or a community, right?
That's true.
So, you drove up here, of course, in your own vehicle or mobile home.
Yeah.
How long have you been housed in this questionable fashion?
Well, just recently, I retired from being a mother, and that has always been my dream, is to travel in my own little dwelling space.
What kind of how big is this dwelling space? How can the police identify it so they can arrest you?
Well, I'm not sure I want to give that information.
Smart woman.
So, I'm sure they know enough about me at this point. We've had some interactions. And I did have more to say as far as...
Oh, sure, I want to hear it, too. I'm going to interrupt you in my usual fashion,
sure.
Annoying my guests and distressing my listeners and giving me the ego satisfaction of feeling like I'm the alpha dog in the studio.
No problem.
No. Don't say that. That removes all the satisfaction of sadistically denouncing you or sort of showing my, superior position on the air. But I actually do want you to say what you're going to say. Regarding your vehicle, how long have you been a former mom and a traveler?
Well, I was a mother for 40 years, and a traveler just probably in the last few months. It's been maybe 4 months now that I've actually been traveling around. And I'm actually here in Santa Cruz because I have a brother who got quite ill and was in the hospital, so I came down here to help my family.
So, in other words, you're not here because of the wonderful social services that are drawing all the homeless people throughout the world to Santa Cruz. As Mayor Coonerty and certain members of the Downtown Association, I suspect, think.
I surely am not. No. Absolutely.
Well, you know, you could be lying, couldn't you? You could really be, you're one of the free meals, aren't you? You're sucking off the tit of Santa Cruz. Come on, let's admit it here.
Well, it seems like at this point in my life, being 62, the older I get, the less I can eat. It started with meat, and then it went to dairy, and now I can't do flour. And so my ability to eat at most free meals is sort of limited as mostly all they have is salads for someone who can't eat.
Now, wait a minute. Are you now you're saying not only are you a scrounger and a moocher and a free meal eater, but you're a picky eater. This sounds even worse. I mean, good grief, woman. How can we convince people of your ilk not to drive into Santa Cruz and... Actually, I'm going to abandon the whole rap. You understand? This is, of course, a satirical rap for those who don't think I'm somehow not... being satirical, but I catch it. You're catching my drift, Anna, because of your occasional chuckle and your failure to eat my chicken salad sandwich, which I offered you earlier. So
it smelled delicious, and I wish I could, but like I said, when I turned 43, I was unable to eat meat without getting physically ill. And you know, processed meat for some reason, I'm assuming because of what they put in it. I don't know.
Interesting. So anyway. Interesting. You know, I may have heard that from others, too. In a way, maybe it gives you, you know, some moral assistance to, you know, because you're not eating these chickens that are bred to be killed and stuffed full of stuff and sitting in the dark in their own shit and whatever they do, these, you know, poor beasts that I devour so regularly and so hungrily. You're reading something, and please continue with your introduction here.
So anyway, that's basically my introduction. I just wish to continue saying that all Santa Cruzans should be thoroughly shamed and embarrassed by the torture, abuse, and even murder, which, if some of you remember, Henry Cowell State Park sweeps back in the late 60s, early 70s, a number of homeless individuals were killed during those sweeps. Living beings whose only real crime is not having a home, and they were killed by your well-paid officials, 30-hour years of paid, same old, many say it's their own fault. And I asked those, do you know the numbers of the military who are homeless because of what we demanded of them and are now unable to sleep in buildings or even at night for fear and flashbacks? Or the children who have no parents who've been released from foster care or who have working parents, etc. Or the mentally challenged or the aged or the work displaced, etc. Because until you have all this info, your choices are uninformed. I would now ask, as Dr. Phil does, and how is this working? You are now spending more money, doing less than you ever have, with the numbers of homeless rising daily.
Well, let me ask you about this claim you have that our police force and other agencies, or who knows who you're accusing, you've named no names, about these deaths in the 60s and 70s. Do you have any more specifics, or are you just going to smear our law enforcement officials as murderous dogs?
Well, the only specifics I have was the newspaper reports at the time, and no one seemed to be too interested in investigating who they were. That's how I originally became an advocate of the homeless, because as a 26-year resident, I didn't feel it was appropriate for people dying just because they were living in tents in the woods. And
how were they dying?
They were shot with 357 Magnum cartridges. Shells were found at the scene of the murders, I do believe.
How many murders are you speaking of?
There were several. That was a very long time ago, so I cannot remember
the statistics,
but there was more than...
I've never heard about this. That's why I'm interested. If you ever get more details, I'd like to know about this.
Well, it was in the news, so we could go back into the archive, I'm sure, and find
still have them. I mean, actually, the Sentinel, the microfiche for Sentinel is in the main public library. So all you researchers out there, you want to check up on Diana for murders in Henry Cowell, you say, homeless murders?
Yeah.
And you suspect that police were involved. Why? Because of the...
Because no one ever investigated. No one ever came up with any idea or anything why these people or how these people died. Some of them didn't even have ID, so they're people, whoever they are, whoever they were.
They were people. Let's not exaggerate. These are former people. Nothing to worry about. Now, you know, the real issue, of course, getting more serious, you know, I mean, to say that a murder isn't investigated means it was committed by those who should be investigating it, I don't think it's not a good syllogism.
It was also at a time when the mounted sheriff's posse were doing sweeps on their horses through the woods to
protect the poor homeless people. Well, for their own protection, to stop these killings.
For whatever reasons.
Before
I'm kidding. I have no idea, actually.
What I'm saying. Before they happen, this is...
A preventive measure by our sheriffs to stop
the... And then the killings happen.
Well, you know, some homeless people refuse to move, and so they get shot. This is unfortunate, I have to say. I mean, I certainly don't favor shooting of all homeless people. Perhaps a thinning out of the homeless population might be appropriate. But, you know, I mean, you've got to separate the good homeless from the ne'er-do-wells, the homeless by choice, the drug addicts, the crazies, the drunks. We need to have a community kind of improvement situation, and after all, downtown business, shall we say, needs a boost. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I would say that if they're going to boost their sales by denying others their right to life, then no, they don't deserve to have anything as far as I'm concerned.
You are such a militant. Don't you understand that the 60s, as I've often said, are a thing of the past? You're out of date. You're passé.
Hey, I'm still breathing. I don't care what you think. I'm still breathing.
This is just
I won't be talking until the day I stop.
You know, your lack of regard for my opinion is very troubling. I've got to tell you, extremely troubling. Now, putting aside all the so-called humor... so-called humor that I'm trying to inject into a very serious situation, actually. So you were a resident of Santa Cruz for 26 years. What, you were born here? Or?
I moved here when I was about 6, and I didn't leave till I was 26 years old.
What kind of a family did you come from?
I came from a very middle-class family, and until the murders up there in Henry Cowell Park, I was one of those people who believed that the homeless should go out and get jobs.
Well, why would the murders persuade you that they shouldn't go out and get jobs?
Well, what the murders persuaded me to do was become more involved in what it was that was going on with the homeless. Because of the murders, I stepped in to find out what was going on. And
how did you do that?
I took a backpack and I moved out onto the streets and lived as a homeless person would live.
For how long was that?
I did it for quite some time. I got very involved with the Food for People program, and I really became an advocate of homeless rights because of those murders.
What years, approximately, would you call it? What span of time are we talking about?
Well, the Food for People program I was doing before 82, so it would have been about 80. It was when the police were really harassing the people, and I think the Food Not Bombs people were actually doing the food. This was before the Catholic Church. And
before Peter Carota's Catholic Soup Kitchen.
Yeah.
Actually, Food Not Bombs wasn't out here. It began in Cambridge in 1978 or 9, and then came out here in 1988. It came to San Francisco. But I'm sure there were equivalent programs.
Yeah,
I don't know who it was.
But I do remember that one of the reasons I got involved with the feeding part of it was because the police had harassed them numbers of times, made them move, and they were saying, we don't want to fight these people, we just want to feed people. And I said, look, this is my town too, and show me how this works. And they showed me how the
and
food
how exactly did it work? What
did
you do?
They worked like 3 or 4 hours a day for three, four days, and the food bank would give them what they needed to feed the people.
Having some problems with your mic again for some reason. Don't ask me why. Let's see how we're doing. Say something into your mic.
Hello.
Say it again.
Hello.
Well, it's hard to tell. Let me quickly try to work through this mass of wires and say that again.
Hello.
It doesn't sound like you're really coming through. Say hello again.
Hello.
Well, just I guess just
hello.
You're good. That's good. Yeah, get up there and kiss the mic. You're doing a good job there.
Hello.
So you actually weren't around in the late 60s and early 70s. We're talking about the late 70s and early 80s, really.
That was when I was doing the Food for People program, yeah. And that was, we worked at the food bank several days a week, several hours a day, and they would supply us with the basics, what we needed to fix meals in the park, and we would fix them at...
Which park did you go to?
San Lorenzo
Park?
San Lorenzo, yes.
And this was like 1980, 81, thereabouts?
Yeah.
And how often did you feed people?
Every day. We fed every day in the park.
What time?
Usually in the evenings, around 4 or 5 o'clock, we would feed them, you know. Everyone would just gather. Usually we would start in the afternoon with preparation, and people would gather and help with the meal, bring water, bring wood for the fire, bring, you know, help with the cutting of the vegetables. And
how many people would you feed?
We figured we'd fed 50 to 100 people on a regular basis, depending upon any day, you know, some more, some less.
And were there hours in the park at that time? I know that I understood in the mid-80s you could sleep, you could be in the park after dark, and you could hang out at night. What about now? I mean, what about then? What was the story then?
Well, it was quite interesting because, as I said before, this other group of people had been doing it prior to my doing it and had been harassed by the city. So when I started doing it, I had the city send me, how I don't know, a clipboard with a piece of paper saying I must be in a building that they could inspect and approve, or I couldn't feed people.
And how many, how long had you been feeding before the city took this clearly sanitary measure to stop you from poisoning the community?
Several months, I would say, before they had done numbers of tactics. They had our pans had disappeared on us and been thrown in the river, and the people that we were feeding are, you know, when you're feeding people, they're not likely to, like, take your stuff. So we pretty much figured it had to be somebody, you know.
What about the neighborhood? What about the community? Were the people who surrounded the park? There's some apartments now. I don't know if they were the same apartments in 1980, but was the community sympathetic to what you were doing?
I doubt seriously that the community was sympathetic to what we were doing, because if the community was sympathetic to any of this, then we wouldn't be sitting here talking about this, I don't believe.
Well, sympathetic in the sense that did you have community members who lived nearby who came out and helped, or did you have community members who wrote nasty letters to the paper, or did both things happen?
Most of our disagreements had to do with authorities, not with neighbors. We didn't have any neighbors come out and participate with us. We didn't have any neighbors, as far as I know, complain about us either.
So you were told you had to go indoors and find a building. What was your reaction to that?
After saying, I don't have to deal with this, and being told, oh, yes, you do, by someone in our group, I went to the city mayor's office. I believe it was a manager, city manager, actually, that I talked to, and explained to him that I could hold a family picnic in a public park every day of the week, and there was nothing they could do about it, and walked out.
What did the city manager, who was probably before our last city manager, Dick Wilson, and certainly well before our current city manager, Martine Brunel, both of whom, or at least, well, they've been around, Dick Wilson particularly has been around when the city attorney, who was not the same one then as he is now, John Barisoni, went after SWAP, Soup Without a Permit, which is a group I worked with, Food Not Bombs, the one we actually became famous in San Francisco and elsewhere, and Feed the People, a group run by Sean Alimi before he died in an untimely auto accident in 1998. So what was you said city manager, you left the city manager's office, and then what followed after that?
Well, the result of that action, because they really didn't have at that point in time, I understand they now have new rules and regulations that allow them to arrest the servers and confiscate their food. At that point in time, they didn't have these regulations. So their response was the next rainy day, I believe it was, there was a change in the sprinklers in the park. And it happened to be on a day that was kind of overcast and cloudy. And everyone was sitting in the park, and we were waiting for a particularly nice pot of beans, because then I was eating meat, and it had meat, which we didn't often get. When the sprinklers came on in the afternoon.
You all took off your clothes and began a rain dance.
Oh, no, we didn't.
No.
I got very upset, and I was pacing back and forth, and this brother says, come with me. And I say, before I realize what I'm doing, okay. And I say, where are we going? He says, to the mayor's office. And I said, okay. So again, we talked to the city manager that time. We went to the mayor's office, and they put us with the city manager, who is in charge of the sprinklers. And it was an interesting conversation, because on the way there, we had come across a Vietnam veteran who had been decorated in the war and was now living on the streets. So we brought him along as well. And got there and told him about the situation, and he started engaging the other people in a conversation regarding what prior harassment the city had done to us.
You started engaging the city manager?
The city manager at the time.
Go ahead.
And when I realized what he was doing was he was just blowing smoke and wasting time, I just nailed him and said, look, if you don't turn off the lawn sprinklers right now, I'm going to the newspaper office. I'm going to announce to them what you're doing, that you're paying to have the lawn sprinkled, not only on a cloudy day, but in the middle of the afternoon when people are in the park. So by the time I got back to the park, the lawn sprinklers had all been turned off.
Maybe it was just a coincidence. Did you ever think of that?
Oh, well, I have to say, although hopefully he's not still working for them, there was a friend of mine who was working at the time for them in the park. He was doing the plants and flowers and such. And he had lived next door to me and him and his wife in Soquel, an apartment building. And so I had known him prior to this. And he came to me on that particular day and told me, because he's the one who had to change the lawn sprinklers, okay? And he had come to me on this particular day and told me to watch myself very carefully. And I said, why? What's going on? And he said, I cannot tell you.
A
but
free
you should
shower.
Watch
I don't see what yes. your complaint is. Again, here is the city trying to facilitate you filthy homeless people, offer you an opportunity to engage in a kind of cleanliness that might benefit everyone.
In the middle of a rain shower, by getting all of their bedding and all of their clothing soaking wet, I don't think they were trying to facilitate anything.
So this was during the rainy season that this all happened?
Yes.
Well, maybe the lawn needed extra raining because it had gotten used to the rain from the skies and because, well, it was helping things along, helping the grass grow, perhaps?
Well, here's the reason why they have the lawn sprinklers set to go on at night, very, very late at night, very early in the morning, when there is no people in the park, when there is supposedly not supposed to be anybody in the park because of the rules and regulations.
Now, were those rules and regulations the case then? Was it illegal to be in the park after dark then when you were there or not?
After a certain time, I think it was like 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. It was later than it is now.
Now it's, of course,
yes.
Dusk. It
right.
best be gone, because we but know there, it's dangerous to be in the park after dark.
Well, there was a period of time when they would have the park closed down, and I'm assuming that's when, well, I know that's when they would sprinkle the lawns normally, and I'm just assuming that they do that so they don't get anyone wet. So there's not a lawsuit against them for destroying someone's clothing or whatever.
Oh, come on, you attorneys. Let's get some lawsuits about the destruction of homeless property. You're listening to Diana Eagle. This is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. Call-in number here is 469-3119. 469-3119. I have to say that on the other line, we're going to be having shortly Ocean Newman from Berkeley calling in, hopefully. And perhaps you can join that conversation, Diana, make some comments, give a perspective that, you know, I'm those of us who don't live in our vehicles like you do might not have. And it's and also, you know, how things, I want to talk to you more about how things look, what changes you've seen from the early 80s to, you know, what, 30-odd years later.
Yeah.
This is Free Radio, again, streaming at freakradio.org. And you can also, if you're interested, you can become a part of Free Radio in the sense you can actually get a show on Free Radio, provided you are, of course, politically correct. That can be obtained by applying to Free Radio. Get an application at freakradio.org. you fill it out and you pass it on to one of our central committee, and then, hey, we, of course, inspect you for subversive activities, and we'll see if you can pass muster, you know, fingernail inspection and so forth. We have a caller, or perhaps we have a call in. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Diana and Robert.
Hi, Robert. It's Osha Newman.
Hey, Osha. Thanks. We were talking about you a moment ago.
Uh-huh.
You are, in fact, a civil rights attorney. You are a worker with what I call the suitcase clinic, but that's not the right name, right?
Neighborhood Justice Clinic. We've morphed.
And you were a former member of the Police Review Commission.
For 8 years, yes.
And you are, of course, a starred feature on the mural right at Haste and Telegraph.
Which I designed and helped initiate, yeah.
So you painted yourself, so to speak.
I don't think I actually appear in that mural.
And it's a good point. I think that I knew you were associated with
it. Yeah, no, I did not go that far. My ego did not extend that far.
You modestly stepped back from that
I wouldn't have fit in.
Well, you were, in fact, you have suffered assaults at the hands of the Berkeley police, even when you were a police review commissioner.
University of California police.
Thank you.
Attacked me, yeah.
So the Berkeley police have steered clear of, should we say, giving you...
I have not been physically assaulted by them, no.
Now, we've been talking down here about, I don't know, you probably haven't been listening to us on the stream, but...
I have not had a chance, no.
The thrill still awaits you. Diana here is an old-time activist here in both Santa Cruz and elsewhere. She now lives in her van. She was active in the early 80s in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And she was talking about... The food programs that were attacked by the city here in Santa Cruz, and
yes.
They still have the problems that they, well, they have continuing problems.
Uh-huh.
What's the story up in Berkeley now? I know that, People's Park is still the location of Food Not Bombs occasionally.
They still, as far as I know, serve a meal there, a lunch, when they can, yes. And they're also... a breakfast and a dinner at the Trinity Methodist Church, which is in south of campus there.
Is that the quarter meal?
Yes, the quarter meal and the wingnut breakfast.
And previously the free meal, of course.
Well, it used to be called the quarter. I know people don't. A quarter is not required, but it still has that name.
Hmm. And... Berkeley has had this, the reason I contacted you, of course, was your work around, you contacted me, actually, at one point, because Berkeley is intending to put into force, some Berkeley politicians would like to see, or merchants, a new sit-lie law prohibiting or restricting sitting on the sidewalks?
Well, we already have a law against lying on the sidewalk in the during the daytime in commercial districts. What they want to do is, in addition, pass a law that would prohibit sitting on those sidewalks.
This, of course, has already been done by initiative in San Francisco, and, of course, it was done by the City Council in Santa Cruz, and I sent you the details of that.
It's been done in Santa Monica and Seattle and various other places, yeah.
And you're a man who's probably looked at these situations. What has been the impact of those laws? Those who support them say... You know, it doesn't. It simply clears the way for the disabled. It removes people who are blocking the important commercial displays that keep our healthy business climate, and that it is. It also stops the drug trade. I don't know, toxic smokers. I've heard numerous justifications for it. What's been your sense of this over the years? I suspect you've probably been a pretty consistent.
Well, yeah, I mean, I mean, the arguments are all the same, and they tend to be, they're utilized in one city, they get transplanted to another. But yeah, I mean, they boil down to complaints about what they call here, in quotes, problematic street behavior, and the proponents of the law support them with anecdotes about bad things that happened on the street either to them or that they observed.
You mean the supporters of the law?
The supporters of the law, right.
Uh-huh.
And the proponents of the law, primarily the merchant associations and the city council members who are beholden to them and see them as their constituency, blame the homeless people sitting on the sidewalk for the fact that they are not getting the customers that they think they would get if those people weren't there, and they also produce anecdotal stories of customers who said, well, they just don't want to come anymore because of the homeless people. That's all pretty standard stuff, I think, that goes around and around.
Now, are they using the phrase homeless? Because in Santa Cruz, they've abandoned that, the supporters of these laws, although they hardly need to because they have a complete unanimous vote on the city council. They expanded them in 2009 and actually made it worse in 2010 as well. They use phrases here like, as you just said, problematic street behavior, abusive panhandling, violence, drugs. Whatever they can throw into the pot, they can. The word homeless, however, they claim is not at all involved. They're not targeting homeless people at all. I mean, that would be unconstitutional.
Well, yeah. No, that's right. Whether it's constitutional or not, they primarily concentrate on, as you said, it's targeting the people who are doing disruptive, unpleasant things on the sidewalk. They in Berkeley, we are still, although they have been organizing for some time quietly behind the scenes, it's only now coming out into the public. So far, they've been talking among themselves and having private meetings with city council members. But you're right. I mean, everybody will know who it's targeted at, and to some degree, that will come out. What they actually since they often deny that the people sitting on the street are actually homeless and claim that they're sort of, freeloaders coming down from the suburbs or whatever and just sort of voluntarily pretending to be homeless. But they, in Berkeley right now, the target is young adults, really. This is what they call transitional age youth, because those are the most visible presence on the street. And among themselves, and to some extent it leaks out to the public, they're very clear that that's what the target is, and they will write it, I'm sure, when we see the law, which we haven't yet, they will write in exceptions for people who are disabled or, because of some infirmity are required to sit on the street.
But no exception.
But everybody knows that is the intended target. I mean, now whether it, at some point in the future it'll be used against some other targeted group, there's no way to prevent that. But
and no exception for the homeless, of course.
No, of course not.
Diana has you have something, Guy? Diana?
Yeah, I have a question. Is that targeting of the so-called young that you're talking about, does that include the young who are out there due to being in foster care and now they're 18 and they have no homes because they were taken from their original homes and now their foster parents are done with them? So they're out on the streets with no support or no anything. Is that the people they're talking
about
targeting?
That's certainly one of the constituents of that group are exactly as you say, young people who aged out, as they say, from foster care. I mean, I think across the country, they have a disproportionate number of the youth who are out on the street and homeless come out of that situation. Not everyone, but that is certainly one of the big feeders onto the street of young people who don't have a home.
Now, OSHA, and we're talking with OSHA Newman of the Berkeley
Neighborhood Justice Clinic.
Thank you. Neighborhood Justice Clinic. I look at the Monday Chronicle. You may have seen the headlines.
I did see that, yeah.
Its sit-lie ban has little effect, say both sides, when hate police pass, vagrants stand to obey the law. And, of course, there was this, what is it? It's a citywide ban during the daytime hours or up until 11 o'clock at night or something or a city.
That's what the San Francisco ordinance says.
In San Francisco, but as yet, according to Bob Offer Westort of Closure on Homelessness, who we've interviewed, they haven't yet issued one citation for this offense.
I think they have now issued one or two. They were waiting for guidelines. But, yeah, I mean, that article it was, I mean, it's not surprising. None of these laws tend to actually have the impact that they're advertised to have, and you know, the people will do what they do, and you can have a million laws also, but when the cops aren't there, then people will do what they want to do. So, just the easiest way to solve for legislators and politicians and so on to give the impression that they're dealing with a social problem is to pass a law criminalizing some targeted group.
Well, why should we care about this if it's simply going to be, you know, as they say in San Francisco, all the cops come along, you stand up, cop leaves, you sit down. I know the answer to this question. It's a trick question. It's a, you know, it's a question I have the answer to already, but, you know, somebody who's listening might think, you know, what's the point? Why care about this if it's going to be, you know, a law passed, to, I don't know, to pander to some conservative, you know, constituency and say, oh, they're, you know, good. I mean, I got a law for them, although it's not going to make any difference. Why do we care?
Well, it doesn't. These laws do make a difference. I mean, it is stressful enough and difficult enough being out of the street, out on the street, and, you know, a lot of the youth who are there don't come from the best of you know, I've had a raw deal and as children, and the stress of anxiety and worry of having these encounters with the police, and this will be another tool that the police will use to harass and to selectively go after those who, for whatever reason, they want to get rid of, and that, you know, the reason will be that they are the youth, and they don't have the credit cards in their pocket, and they're not buying.
So,
but it has an impact. They will issue citations. Those citations are not trivial. I mean, in Berkeley, there's no way for a homeless person who was issued a citation to deal with it in Berkeley. It would require that person to somehow make the trek down to Oakland and stand in line at 6 or 7 in the morning to maybe get in front of a judge. And what happens generally, and this is part, I think, of you know, this strategy, is they know that these the people who are issued those citations won't, in fact, be able to deal with them. They'll go to warrant. Once they've gone to warrant, the police have a ready-made hook just to pick up whenever they want the kid who's out on the street, and in Berkeley it'll be a kid, and cart him off to Santa Rita. And all of that has a really...
Santa Rita's a jail.
It's a county jail, you know, and, you know, all of this has, you know, a really terrible effect on young people. I mean, they have a history of abuse often, and this is a... Here is society being abusive, you know, sort of repeating abuse.
Now, are these misfits?
Let's remember that this is our future we're talking about. These individuals are going to be the future people who are left when we're gone. And the way that we're treating them now is not going to be the healthiest and the most positive benefit that can be when these children are older and making decisions and choices that are affecting everyone.
Are these misdemeanors or infractions under the law?
Well, they'll probably be in I don't know how they'll eventually get charged.
Let me ask,
there are many of the laws that are I mean, first of all, there are plenty of laws in Berkeley that allow them to figure out a way to issue citations to whoever they want to issue right now. And they actually issue citations for, essentially for sitting on the sidewalk, although they have a little workaround, so it isn't, they
what,
don't specifically say that's what they're doing. They're issuing citations for having stuff on the sidewalk. So if a person is sitting on the sidewalk and happens to have a backpack next to them, they'll issue the citation for blocking the sidewalk with a backpack rather than for sitting. But and those are often cited as misdemeanors. They have a choice. But the problem is that even if they it's an infraction, the failure to go to court and deal with that infraction, which and that failure is almost guaranteed in the case of these young people, that when they don't go to court and don't deal with it, they get a warrant, and the failure to appear is a misdemeanor.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In Santa Cruz, they abandoned failure to appear warrants on infractions in 2006. Instead, they do what's called a failure to pay additional charge, which they then simply find you guilty for in absentia, and they send that south with an additional $300 fine to a collection agency. And so they've abandoned warrants for infractions in Santa Cruz. And then when people continue to ignore them, particularly for tickets for sleeping at night, which is illegal in Santa Cruz on public property, they passed a new law which made three unattended infractions a new misdemeanor.
Right. Well,
yeah. So I mean,
that's what I mean. They do find ways to escalate these into misdemeanors. I mean, but here in Berkeley, the failure to appear
is being issued for infractions.
It becomes automatically a misdemeanor.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We're talking with Osha Newman of Berkeley. Osha, this I remember coming up to Berkeley in the mid '90s, '94, early in '94, after the Seattle sitting ban had been found constitutional in the roulette decision of the Ninth Circuit Court.
Yeah.
Berkeley apparently, you know, tried to put one through City Council. The City Council refused. Instead, it became, I guess, propositions N and M on the ballot.
No, that's not. It's close to what happened. In actual fact, the City Council passed a law against sitting and lying on the sidewalk. The opponents of that law organized
referendum.
Got it passed a referendum staying the enforcement of that and putting it on the ballot.
Uh-huh.
And then it went on the ballot as Measure N, I believe. There was two, N and O. And that passed.
Narrowly.
The voters voted for it. And then the ACLU and other organizations sued Berkeley for challenging the constitutionality of that law on its face, and the federal judge who heard the case initially ruled in favor of the ACLU, but then after she'd issued her ruling, the decision in a case called Roulette versus Seattle, came down. A Ninth Circuit decision that affirmed the legality of laws against sitting. She was then vacated her ruling, and so the law would have gone in. But what happened in the time that elapsed after the law was passed and the election, a new city council came in that was. Had a different component, and that new city council then repealed the sitting part of the law, but the lying on the sidewalk part of the law after night remained in effect and is still in effect today.
And has it been used much against people lying down on the sidewalk?
It is not used that much because most people, if they have a choice between just lying out on the sidewalk or going into a doorway or under an awning where it's more protected or onto the steps of a church where there might be an overhang in the rain, then they get cited more for trespassing on property that's posted with no trespassing signs. So actually, it's not enforced that much. It's an odd situation, so that it's legal to sleep out, to lie on the sidewalk during those hours, but if you just go, let's say, under an awning of a vacant store or in a doorway of a vacant store, then that becomes trespassing.
And has there been, as happens in some cities like San Francisco and to some extent Santa Cruz, a general call to the merchants, and the merchants call to the police to enforce trespassing statutes against people sleeping under awnings and in doorways at night when stores are closed.
Yeah, the city regressively goes around, and if a merchant is allowing homeless people to sleep on the property, they are likely to get a little visit from the police officers, and the city of Berkeley has made up some red no trespassing private property signs with sort of plastic signs that they dole out to the merchants to place in their windows and put up on their storefront.
Now, are merchants pressured who want to allow homeless people to sleep there unmolested to change their policy?
I think there's some of that. I mean, what happens in my experience is that there may be merchants who really don't care that much, and then a police officer will come by, see somebody sleeping on the property, will issue a ticket, and then if that person would like the merchant to come to court or write a letter saying that the person who was ticketed had a permission, the merchant tends not to want to do that because they don't want to get in trouble with the police. So it's rare. I mean, I have had one case where a person was issued, I think, maybe 25 or 30 citations for sleeping in an abandoned in a little alcove of a closed store, and I did manage to get a hold of the owner of who had inherited. Actually, it was a trustee who had had the right control of the property after the owner had died, and that person was, you know, really good guy, really nice, very sympathetic, and he wrote a letter saying that the homeless person sleeping there had permission to do that, and he was happy to have him there. But that's the exception rather than the rule.
Well, you know, that raises a good question. I mean, it sounds like the homeless person has to present some kind of evidence that they have permission, when isn't it, in fact, the responsibility of the owner or the owner's agent to show that they have given warning to people not to be there?
Well, the warning, there's two statutes in Berkeley. The sign that they put up is the warning. If there's a sign up that's been posted by the owner or the person who has in charge of the property that says private property, no trespassing, there's no necessity in Berkeley to give an additional warning.
Are most properties so posted along Pacific, Telegraph and Shattuck Avenues?
There are a lot of them are. I mean, there are always issues about how well they're posted, whether they're, you know, the signs are visible or not.
Well, perhaps more to the point,
they're torn down, but very many of them are.
More to the point, are there properties that aren't posted where people do sleep, but the police come after them with trespass tickets anyway?
Well, there's another statute that says that if the owner has warned the person not to sleep there, or a person who's a designated agent of the owner issued a warning and the person continues to sleep there, then the person can be cited, and the police solicit from owners letters which to the police department saying that they would want the police to enforce no trespassing on their property, and then that case, if there's no sign,
there's a
requirement to issue a warning first.
Do police go after people where the owners have not either issued a warning or posted a sign?
Well, that's rare. I mean, pretty much in the commercial areas, there are
very few places where.
I mean, because there's certain areas where there's more likely that homeless people will try and seek shelter. I mean, there are areas sort of in the downtown commercial corridors, and then sort of in the immediate periphery. And
I guess what I'm looking to understand is whether there are some merchants who are essentially, you know, not interested in driving away homeless people, who haven't posted signs, haven't given warnings, and yet they are, through one means or another, stopped from doing that by the police or by, I don't know, the downtown association or the whatever?
Well, they're very few. I mean, I think even the ones who are sympathetic to the homeless people and wouldn't enforce it, still very often there will be a no trespassing sign. I mean, it's just a merchant who may feel that he or she relies on the police for protection and the ability to call the police in the case of somebody coming in and being disruptive or stealing, is reluctant to defy them.
Is this then a police agenda rather than a merchant issue? Now, is it the police department that wants to make it a uniform get out of town kind of sign, or don't sleep here, or don't lie down here, something that the police are essentially the main force for?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to say, but I think probably what it is that the police respond to what they perceive as the stakeholders, and when it's the merchants who are most likely to put in a call to the city council member or to the city manager or the police complaining, and then the word goes down to the beat cop, you have to be more aggressive around it. I mean, they see their constituency as the property owners, the business owners, and if those groups are complaining about lack of enforcement, then the word comes down to the street cop.
But it's not a sort of a variegated situation where the cops are advised, well, everybody on this block except for stores A, B, and C has either posted or warned, just stay away from these blocks of these particular stores because they haven't. They don't. There's not that kind of. It's more sort of like a blanket sense of no trespassing, whether there's a sign or not. Is that an accurate assessment or?
Well, as I say, I mean, pretty much, if you walk up and down the street, the vast majority of the stores have signs,
I
don't know whether there's certain merchants who are particularly incensed, and so they get special attention from the police. It's possible. I know that in one of our cases, unfortunately, the owner of Amoeba Records, who's a pretty progressive guy, but whose business is having a very hard time in Berkeley, wrote a letter for a police officer in a case that I had, complaining about how difficult his business has become, partly because of the homeless people there. And that person probably, you know, says the word goes to the beat cops if particularly in front of, in this case, Amoeba Records, you know, we want you to move people along.
Amoeba Records, of course, at the corner of Haste and Telegraph.
That's correct.
And that's also not far from the Mediterranean Cafe, and then across the street, Moe's Books, which was recently the site of a protest organized by Michael Delacour and others.
Well, the guy actually, the Mr. Becker, who's the proprietor of the Mediterranean, is one of the most virulent in his support of laws against sitting. I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, I think Mark is basically a good guy. I hope to be able to talk to him. I don't think he's a bad fellow. I think he's just stressing. He has a $30,000 a month rental bill. I mean, that's crazy. And if you're paying $30,000 rent in this economy, and you're running a record store, and your business is being slammed by the iPods and iTunes and
Mark of Amoeba Records we're talking.
Yeah.
Can I get, I mean, I wanted to get some discussion, because I read about it in the online publication, the Berkeley Daily Planet, about these protests against Moe's Books and Mediterranean Cafe around the issue of their support for sitting bans. But also, there was some claims that the Mediterranean had been hog-tying or duct-taping people when they were arresting them or something.
That I never heard.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I'd be surprised.
Yeah, I haven't heard.
That didn't come by my arm.
That's what I heard from Al on the street, who's an associate of Russell Bates.
I no idea. It's interesting, but I hadn't
heard. I got you.
It doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No, I understand. And I wondered if you'd heard anything. Go ahead, Diana.
I just have a question here, and that is to all of those who are proceeding with these rules, laws, and regulations, is these are living, breathing beings on this planet. What do you propose they should do? Where should they go? Where are they allowed in their right to life to sit, to be, to sleep, to eat? They don't have a house, so they can't go there.
Well, you know, the people who are supporting this, they really, I think, basically they don't give a damn. I mean, what they say is that they want them to go somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
Where that
the
is,
word.
They
yeah.
don't know. And in fact, one of their arguments for wanting to pass this law is that because Santa Cruz and Santa Monica and now San Francisco have these laws, they raise the specter that Berkeley will be flooded with homeless people who are driven out of these cities by the laws that they've passed, for which there's no evidence whatsoever. But
do they want the homeless to leave the planet? Is that their plan?
I don't think they care about the planet. They care about their little
NIMBY, not in my backyard. That's
their turf. I mean, yeah. If there's somewhere else, anywhere else is fine. It's mainly their turf.
Now,
where?
You know, you were around, were you not, OSHA, during the 80s when there was the Rainbow Village of vehicles in Berkeley?
Yeah.
And this has been cited by former Mayor Mike Rotkin as an example of a failed kind of homeless village, mm-hmm. or a vehicular village, and an example why such activities or such communities are bound to fail. I have not got quite the perspective that former Mayor Rotkin has, and I wondered, since you were on the scene at that time, can you tell us, do you have any recollection of the Rainbow Village and why it ended and what went down with that?
Well, I don't know that I have any direct personal connection to it. And by the way, I think there's a very successful village where in Portland that's been going on. Dignity Village has been going on for some time. But what happened is that there was an election, and Gus Newport, who was probably the most progressive mayor that we've ever had, was elected. And at the time, there people were living in their vehicles, their trucks, their buses, and vans, or whatever, along a residential street in West Berkeley, and the neighbors were having a problem. And shortly before that, the dump, the Berkeley landfill, had been closed, and I think ground had been dirt had been put over it. It's now Cesar Chavez Park. And so the idea was proposed to set up an encampment where the people could come and park their vehicles and be free to stay there without getting in the way of the neighbors.
This was actually done in Ontario, California, a couple years ago, and I may even still be there, although the city imposed severe restrictions, particularly in the midst of the foreclosure crisis, when people were being driven out of their homes into vehicles, and people who had, were not, hippies or travelers or earth folks or tree huggers or anything of that sort. They just, had no place to go except a car and a vehicle. Go ahead.
So what happened is it happened. I mean, they set it up. They called it Rainbow Village. The problem, I think, is that they put it out there. It was kind of far from everybody, and they just kind of left it. And there were no oversight. There were no services and so on. It was sort of left to its own devices, and it began to sort of devolve, and there were instances of violence, and I think somebody may have been killed or very badly hurt, maybe even killed out there. And when that happened, that was the end of it, and they closed it down. But I mean, it was a failed experiment, but the failure was sort of foreseeable, and there would have very had it been done in a different way rather than just sort of setting it up and leaving it, had they paid attention to it, provided services to people there, had folks come out and see what was going on and check on it, and if there was in fact violent elements dealing with them, none of that happened. And so it did. Unfortunately, it closed. And whenever you do have those kind of failed experiments, everybody looks at them and says, oh, well, we can't try anything like that because that one didn't work.
We originally began by talking about the proposed sitting ordinance, which you don't have a copy of yet. It hasn't been revealed to you.
No, we haven't seen it yet.
But what I know in San Francisco, I've heard talk that there's talk about challenging the sitting ordinance Measure L. Yet you've discussed the fact that the attempted, the overturning of the judicial enforcement of civil rights for homeless people was overturned in Berkeley in the 90s. What's the prospects of a significant legal challenge of a sitting ordinance in Berkeley or in San Francisco or anywhere else in the state, in your estimation?
Well, there are two issues. One of them is what would be the legal basis of it? It looks like a challenge to the law, the way the lawyers put it, on its face. That is, just you look at the law, how it's written. You don't look at how it's enforced. And as it's written, if you just look at that law, can you tell whether it's constitutional or not? And it looks like that challenge to a law that criminalizes sitting, just because that, as a violation of the Constitution, the various cases, Roulette in particular out of Seattle, forecloses that possibility. That is, that what the Seattle court says is the challenge was based on that it was a violation of the First Amendment, the right to assemble and speak in a public space. And what the Roulette court said, well, the nexus, the connection between sitting and speaking isn't close enough to justify overturning the law. And when it reached that conclusion, it didn't go any further. But it did say it left open the possibility that the law could be challenged as applied. That is, the way it's written, okay, if you just look on its face, it passes constitutional muster, but it's being applied in a way that is not constitutional, and the way it would be applied unconstitutionally is it was applied arbitrarily and discriminatorily.
Now, you may remember a couple of years ago, I think you were at this conference up at Bolt, maybe it was, where we had people from different parts of the state, ACLU people particularly, around the issue of the sleeping bans statewide. This is at a time when I think the Jones settlement, the Jones decision was a decision and not yet a settlement.
Right.
And so it was a precedent, at least for part of the area, a part of the state.
Yeah.
And the issue became, to some extent, what would be the best way to make a challenge to sleeping bans and maybe to sitting bans. I don't know if that came up as in that particular way, but and it was suggested by some ACLUers down in Los Angeles that disability is an important criteria and that it could be the basis for overturning these laws because they violate, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Well, most of the laws, I suspect when this one is written, it will have an exception for people who have to sit because of their disability.
Does the current Berkeley law, now you have some kind of law criminalizing living in your vehicle or sleeping in your vehicle or some such thing?
It is inhabiting a house car.
Does it have a disability exception?
The house car one, no.
And yet, that has either withstood a challenge or not been challenged.
No, there's never been a constitutional challenge.
What would be your prediction for a successful constitutional challenge on the basis of a disabled person?
Probably not. I mean, on its face, I don't think you could challenge it. I mean, the person would have to show that there was no alternative for that person to be inside, I'm guessing. I mean, they'd have to show that there were no shelters, there was no no possibility of them getting some other
Well, of course, that
place
was
to be.
That was
if that were the case, then you know you might be able to make an argument. It's the defense of necessity or cruel and unusual.
Right. Well, the defense of necessity was ruled as something that can always be used in camping cases under the ICORN decision.
That's right.
But I'm talking about whether you could challenge the law and saying, look, this provides no exception for disabled people, and therefore people even with disability placards who live in their vehicles are going to be penalized in their vehicles, and doesn't this in some way violate some basic constitutional right they have? Your thought is that you don't see
probably
any...
not, because the response would be, well, you know, if they have some other place to be, and you haven't made the case that no homeless person ever has a different place to some other place to be, then it's not. There's no reason not to pass that law.
And they would claim that if a person is disabled, if they get a ticket, all they have to do is go show that the shelters are full, and they can somehow get the ticket dismissed.
Well, I don't know. We've never had that. I don't know how that would play out. I really don't.
So we're talking with Osha Newman of Berkeley, attorney who for years has been defending homeless people in court. How many people a year would you say you go to court for, Berkeley, in Berkeley?
Well,
Osha?
A neighborhood justice clinic? You know, probably, I don't know, a couple of hundred? I don't know. I mean, we see a lot of people.
How successful are you as
we're very successful. I mean, I think we have probably a 97% success rate.
And what are the main cases, what kind of cases, what category do you pursue?
Primarily what we call quality of life citations. That is, people who are cited for some activity which, but for the fact they're homeless, would be legal. I mean, for example, trespassing, people who trespass because they need a place to sleep. Everybody who has a house has a place to sleep, and so they can sleep without any question of it being becoming a crime. Putting your backpack down on the sidewalk because you have no place else to put it, which is not a problem for people with houses because they have closets and rooms where they can store things.
Now, when you take these cases to court, do you normally use technical defenses, like the cop hasn't shown up, or
use anything we can? We'll use a technical defense. Consciousness.
In the main, are there any constitutional arguments you make that have been particularly and repeatedly successful?
We've been successful on challenging, for example, an Oakland ordinance that makes it a crime to solicit money for yourself. We did a constitutional challenge to that that was successful. We also do challenges when we think that the law that's being used, in fact, doesn't apply. For example, there's a law against vending and soliciting people to buy your product or to employ you. When it's used against people who are panhandling, we think the law doesn't apply. We've succeeded in those cases.
Now, in Berkeley and throughout the Bay Area, homeless people sell the newspaper Street Spirit and Street Sheet. Have they encountered any problems with authorities for trying to do that?
Yes. In Oakland, there have been cases where there have been problems. Not as far as I know in Berkeley at various times. We've generally been able to get the city to back off those and to defend them.
In Orlando, Florida, the food servers are facing serious challenges from authorities there. What's the situation with food servers in Berkeley? Are they being left alone?
Well, the ones who are serving the quarter meal and the wingnut breakfast, those are in churches, and they are presumably the health department is certify the facilities where the food is cooked. The people who have the problem are Food Not Bombs folks, and they certainly the university is unhappy that they are serving in People's Park, but so far there haven't been the kind of multiple arrests of people for violation of the health laws that happened, for example, in San Francisco a number of years ago.
And People's Park, of course, is a space established originally by the community, you know, for community use.
Right.
And as frequently, I mean, now I think it's divided into thirds, and the city owns part of it, and the university leases part of it, or vice versa.
No, that was for a while. Right now, the university is the city gave up their stake.
Was that a major defeat for user development of People's Park, in your view?
No, the city wasn't in favor of user development. I mean, they just had some agreement with Berkeley to share the pain with the university, but they were neither the university nor the city has been particularly interested in user development.
Now, I've heard that there used to be a thing called the free box where people could drop off clothing and then others could pick it up as they needed it, and that the university and police departments, one or the other or both, have been regularly destroying those boxes while activists have been recreating them. Is that still the case?
There was a whole period of the free box wars, and it was that exactly as you described, but in the end, so far the police have triumphed, and right now there is no free box.
There's also, of course, a case of what Matt Dott, the fellow in the tree who's accused of stabbing some other homeless person, and that there's some controversy about the university's breaking up a tree sit, or the police department's breaking up a tree sit, and there's charges going on around that. Do you know anything about that case?
It's murky. I don't know that much about it. It's true that a guy named Laughing Wolf initiated a tree sit. It was pretty much, I think, not a mass-supported action, but there was a tree sit. Matt was up in a tree. There was an incident. I think what happened there was there was tension with the homeless people who were there, because the homeless people felt there was heat coming down on them because of the tree sit. In fact, the police sort of instigated that by telling the homeless people that they were going to get heat because of that, and I think that was contributory to the incident. But I have no real first-hand information about it.
So if anybody wants to ask OSHA a question, you've been very patient with us, OSHA, for the last 45 minutes.
And I would probably have to go in about 10 minutes.
Sure. No, I mean, I want to give you a chance to get out of here gracefully. The phone number to call in is 469-3119, area code 831-469-3119. If you'd like to ask OSHA a question or make a comment or, perhaps give some of your experience and get his thoughts on the subject. What I talked to you about this earlier, OSHA, about setting up some kind of legal service for poor and homeless people. You see very, increasingly cutbacks in all kinds of social services, and I'm sure that, I mean, for years there haven't been really any decent legal services for homeless people generally, except those privately funded by grants and so forth. Do you have any optimism about this for the future? Does it look pretty grim?
Yeah, I mean, we all know the kind of situation we're in now. I mean, the Wall Street siphoned off all the money in the bank to pay their gambling debts, and there's not much left for anything else. And what remains, a good massive chunk is going into all our various wars. So that's what's going on here. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and the states that are by law required to balance their budgets are slashing and burning. And what's getting slashed and burnt are services for vital necessary services for poor people. So, no, I mean, everything is on the block, and it's we're heading into a really difficult situation. I mean, health care, whatever, and certainly for years, money for legal services for the poor has totally dried up, and there's very, very little left. I mean, the organization I work for is a lucky exception. And just as all of this is going to mean that as people become desperate and have no real way to survive and make a living, they are going to get funneled from, you know, welfare that's being cut and childcare being cut and jobs that are non-existent, they're going to end up in jail. I mean, they're going to end up in the legal system, and the resources to defend them at precisely the time when the resources to defend them are drying up. So what, you know, for a lot of folks, they will be thrown onto a completely overburdened public defender system, and the people that we do, the reason why we represent people who get these quality of life infractions is if you get an infraction, you're not eligible for a public defender. So people have no representation for that. So it's, yeah, I mean, this is, we're in a major crisis. And what's happening is that as in the midst of the crisis, it is being used as an excuse for a agenda that involves blaming the most the victims of it, the people who have the least, and cutting what they need vitally. So, in for example, in Wisconsin, where they have a genuine crisis, as all the states do, the governor uses an excuse to bust the public unions.
After passing
Berkeley, where I'm well believed that merchants are struggling, they are using the fact that they're having a hard time to take that opportunity to get to move their agenda. They've wanted to have a law against sitting in Berkeley for years and haven't been able to do it. And so this is their opportunity.
What about the drug war and its impact on the homeless? How is that working in Berkeley? I know that Berkeley, I guess, slightly modified the laws opening up, allowing more marijuana dispensaries, medical marijuana dispensaries, but of course, poor people usually can't afford that.
No, that stuff's real expensive.
So you have poor people trying to succeed by selling street drugs?
And of course. I mean, poor people are always trying to sell street drugs.
And is that something that you find yourself moving to defend at all, or you feel you have to sort of set yourself aside from the poisoned drug cases?
Well, the thing is, if you're busted for selling, you're actually, if that is a misdemeanor, or depending on the drug and the amount of felony, and they are... If a person is eligible for the public defender, then that's where they get their defense. We deal with people who are not eligible for the public defender. So if you're just busted for possession of under an ounce, you know, we will, in many cases, represent you.
Hmm. Well, I think I may have run out of steam here.
Okay.
But I guess the last question might be the first one you asked me when you called up, which is you were concerned about stats that were being cited by city officials or downtown business people that claimed in Santa Cruz there was some kind of a correlation between the sitting ban here and business improvement. Have you gotten any further with that research?
You know, I have. In fact, I'm looking for the contact people that you mentioned. But that is a major argument that's being put forward. And it's one that we're going to have to deal with.
Is there a website you suggest people go to if they want to follow these issues more closely,
I can give you a email address, and from there you'll be able to get whatever information you need.
All right.
It's stand up and then the number 4, right to sit down at gmail.com, all one together. Stand up, number 4, right to sit down at gmail.com.
And is this...
That's our email for our coalition.
Huh. And you've got some literature you're putting out. People can get it if they...
Yes, that's a way. If you're interested, that's the you know, drop an email to that address.
Thank you, Osha.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, man. That was Osha Newman of Berkeley, longtime activist, attorney with the Berkeley... It's some kind of legal clinic, but I don't think I got the actual name. But if you go to stand up number 4, stand up 4, right to sit down at gmail.com, you can get more information on that particular struggle that he's involved in. You are tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM. Were we broadcasting? I guess since we're not, you're going to have to be content with, or we are going to have to be content with, and we're all going to have to be content with, freakradio.org, which is what we're streaming at, freakradio.org. Stay with us as we take a brief musical break. I'm here in the studio with Diana Eagle. You can call in if you want. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. That was another by Carol Denny from The Rich Will Never Be Poor. I thought I was going to play you Crystal Capitol Records, but it doesn't look like that was that. So we'll see why we're a little mucked up on this particular recording. I want to thank you, Diana Eagle, for being with me. Keep up the good work. We'll see you. I guess you'll be coming to the protest on next Monday, April 4th, which I'm going to be talking about in the next few minutes. There's, of course, a closing of the armory, and there'll be a protest at the court building at 701 Ocean Street.
And that's at 10 a.m., right?
It is at 10 a.m. on Monday morning. Be there, be square.
Right on.
And let the authorities beware.
Yes.
All right, then. So, yeah, let me talk a little bit about that. We have about half an hour left in the show. Folks are, of course, invited to call in, 427-3772. The HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, had a meeting yesterday. We do it every week at the Sub Rosa at 10:30. And a fairly large meeting. Our meetings are getting larger, maybe because more people are homeless or are interested or bored and nothing better to do. Hard to say, but our meetings are getting bigger. And there were people there who were quite enthusiastic about doing a protest around a couple of issues. One of them has to do with the fact that there are a number of people, I've talked about them repeatedly, who are being prosecuted for and face jail for essentially peaceful protesting, picketing, carrying signs, and displaying literature at night for being in public spaces, opposing the sleeping ban and the laws that criminalize people in public spaces at night. And the particular group of people that I'm talking about are the Santa Cruz the Peace Camp 6, I think they may be called. They are being defended by attorney Ed Fry, who is one of the six, and there were actually more than 40 people who received misdemeanor, up to a year in jail, $1,000 fine, 647E tickets. That's Penal Code 647E, which makes lodging an illegal act if you are lodging without the permission of the requisite authority. And lodging, of course, is, strangely enough, not defined in the ordinance. So if standing could be lodging, sitting could be lodging, kneeling and praying could be lodging, sleeping could be construed as lodging. And there are at least 7 people who are going to a jury trial on this issue in April or May. Linda LeMaster's been on the air. She's talked about that issue. She'll be one of the speakers, as will Ed Fry. Another one of the defendants is also a lawyer himself and a defender for the other 5, including himself, which might not be the best idea, but it should be interesting to see. He will be speaking as well, 10 o'clock on Monday morning, April 4th. There'll be some hot food, maybe some hot coffee and some coffee cake and a little something to keep us warm, although it looks like the weather is getting a lot warmer, though I understand there's rain due on Saturday, is what I hear for all you folks who think that the weather has gotten better. For the moment it has, really nice today, but who knows how it's going to be. In any case, there is this protest coming up on Monday that we decided to do at the HUF meeting because of, the Peace Camp 2010 activists who for 3 months, many of them night after night, endured police harassment. They endured harassment from vigilantes, uncomfortable conditions outside, in order for the first month to establish a safe zone for over 50 homeless people at different points. And there was a porta potty there, the only one open at that time of night, the only bathroom open to the general community, or at least to the homeless community, in the downtown area. And still, now there's no bathrooms open in the downtown area after 10 o'clock, unless you happen to be in a bar and happen to be willing to spend money or sneak into a bar or, I don't know, beg your way into a gas station. And that can be very difficult while you're trying to hold your water at the same time. I don't know if the Homeless Service Center still keeps its bathroom open at night as it used to under former executive director Doug Loisel out there at 115 Coral Street. If anybody has any information on that, I'd like to know what you know. Just give a call, 427-3772. But so one of the issues is defending this group of people, the Peace Camp 2010 folks who are facing trial. And a lot of folks who we don't know their names, but they've gotten failures to appear, warrants. Police are looking for them, and their crime is sleeping at night and or protesting peacefully during the day. It is an astonishing abuse of public power, of the public police power, to go after people in this way rather than address the issue. But that, of course, most of us historically looking at these issues understand that's what happens when you raise issues that are really uncomfortable with the ruling class, with the establishment, with the settled and the wealthier people in the community. And that's what's happened in Santa Cruz, as it's happened in other cities, particularly as economic conditions have gotten worse. So that's one reason for this April 4th protest, 10 o'clock at 701 Ocean in front of the county building, actually right in front of the courts. And you're invited to come on down. The other speakers, I'll be speaking, I believe, Steve Plaich, who is a former council candidate, activist with Needle Exchange and Suicide Prevention, main inspiration behind the Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners that were essentially cut short initially by the city and county's lockout of the Veterans Building. Steve Plaich will be speaking. He's also an anti-war activist who is trying to work with others, myself included, to get a rally going on April 9th, 5 days later at the town clock. It'll be, I guess, the following Sunday, or maybe the following Saturday. I'm not quite sure when the 9th is. Say 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th. I guess that's, yeah, I think that's the next Saturday. So there are going to be some interesting speakers there. We may do a march of some kind over to the city attorney's office. This is the same city attorney, John Barisone, who is harassing homeless people with new laws that make it even more threatening to try to survive in public spaces by making unattended infraction tickets misdemeanors, by making all subsequent infraction tickets to those after the first three unattended ones, each one a misdemeanor punishable by a year in jail and a $1,000 fine, by colluding to set up new crimes for being in at City Hall, on the City Hall grounds at night, when that has for decades been a constitutional right not to sleep. You can still go after people for sleeping there if you choose to be barbaric and abusive, as the city often is with respect to homeless protesters. But you had been able to stay awake with the sign at night. Now it is illegal to do that. They've set up forbidden zones at the City Hall. Similarly at the library, no longer legal to sit on the benches at night at the library or be on the library grounds. Again, increasing incrementally the amount of territory forbidden to not just homeless people, but to the entire community, because the target is homeless people. And that's really what is so, that's one of the aspects that should make middle-class people concerned about this, that they're not only taking away the rights of those, you know, suspicious, questionable, or lamentable, but oh well, let's, you know, those homeless people, ain't it a shame, but they're also taking away your rights, those of you who aren't homeless. If the police officer sees you in these areas at night, you are subject to a citation or at the very least harassment and a form of the kind of imposition and police officer stepping into your life in a way that I can assure you does not feel comfortable at all and feels like essentially a violation of your human dignity. At least that's been the way it seemed to me throughout many of my encounters with the police department. Because it's not really a legitimate concern. Because what's happening is you are being threatened with a kind of gentle terrorism, fear, a gentle form of threatened force of coercion if you don't follow the program of the politicians in power with their schemes to control the poor. And it's a disgrace. It's a shame. It's a waste of taxpayer money, and it's, of course, a human rights violation. So the Peace Camp 2010 is one of the targets that this protest is concerned about. Another reason that we're there and will be there on April 4th has to do with the fact that the Armory Winter Shelter, which is no bargain for people to go up there anyway, but is for 75 to 100 people a place to get out of the rain, out of the wind, provided you're willing to be, you know, under difficult conditions that for some people they cannot deal with, provided you have picture ID, provided you don't have too much stuff with you, provided you don't have to drive up there in your own vehicle, if you're not allowed to do that, provided you don't have a job that takes you past 4 or 5 o'clock, because you have to line up at that point, provided you haven't gotten on the bad side of the monitors, provided you aren't worried about getting sick by being in the same room with 100 other people, some of whom may be coughing and ill. All these are ifs, but if, you know, still there's place for 75 to 100 people, and those people will be dumped out on April. Last night is April 3rd. April 4th, the night of April 4th, there will be no place for those folks to sleep. And there are some, and this will be the third, well, there'll be some who want to establish a Peace Camp 2011, a new tent city, I've called it a Coonertyville, after our mayor, Ryan Coonerty. And as they used to call the tramp encampments of the 30s Hoobervilles, this would be a Coonertyville, because it really is necessitated by the failure of the mayor to allow homeless people limited public areas in which to pitch their tents and set up encampments of necessity at night. Or alternately, to suspend the sleeping ban in various areas so that people can do this and set up some porta-potties, so people can have some facilities to use. Instead, the city likes to maintain that it has a liberal policy when, in fact, its policy is capricious, arbitrary, and is based on a law that simply states there's no legal place for people to sleep after 11 o'clock at night, and you're subject to a fine and eventually to jail. Because if you don't deal with each of these tickets, which involves not just necessarily paying a fine, but paying a fee if you want to do what's called community service, which some of us call community slavery, it is difficult, and actually it's a form of driving homeless people out of sight and out of town. Now, the third reason that this protest is being heard, the first for, again, Peace Camp 2010 support in court, the second, the fourth reason, for the, dramatizing the fact that the armory is closing the night before, the third for possibly beginning a dialogue around a Peace Camp 2011 opening up, but the fourth reason has to do with the fact that huge amounts of money have been given to the city attorney specifically to go after homeless people who are violating infractions as part of that chunk, which now is it's $225,000. I think it's actually $225,000, which was disguised as some sort of rental inspection fees. But when Don Lane pulled it off the agenda, and I have not yet listened to the tape on this, and I was not at the city council meeting last Tuesday, I should say a week ago Tuesday when it happened, it actually turned out to be money for the police and the city attorney to go after poor people charged with what you've heard Osha Newman describe as quality of life crimes. That is to say, if you don't meet our quality of life and contribute to our pristine environment, we're going to find you criminal to get you out of here. And that's what these sitting bans, sleeping bans, panhandling bans, forbidden zones, all these laws are designed to do. And so the city attorney might be the subject of a march to his office, maybe even a sleepout at his place. That's been discussed. We're not sure. It depends on what the people who show up want to do. You can show up again 10 o'clock on Monday, and that's going to be a protest that will be coming up, complete with India Joe Schultz's tasty coffee cake, perhaps. I'm not quite sure what he's going to be serving. Maybe some hot, yummy soup. And perhaps some coffee, who knows? Keep everybody awake so that we can follow the law and stay awake. Actually, during the day, it's legal to go to sleep, so maybe we should all go to sleep downtown in front of the businesses somewhere to dramatize our gratitude to these wonderful businesses who have done so much to support poor and homeless people and their rights to basic human rights in Santa Cruz. And of course, I'm being very sarcastic here. And then the fifth reason that this protest is being held has to do with the new law that was passed this fall regarding the waiting list exception. The sleeping ban now, according to the city attorney, John Barasone, will not be imposed on people, or if, to put it more exactly, those who are ticketed for sleeping or camping, those who are rousted, ID checked, searched, have their property gone through, told to move on, can later have their tickets dismissed if they are on a waiting list at the Homeless Services Center at the date when the police charged in and invaded their space and gave them a ticket for sleeping or camping in Santa Cruz. Now, these waiting lists are interesting. They are the kind of the fictional equivalent, they're sort of virtual shelter or imaginary shelter or fanciful shelter. They're a list you get onto where you might get shelter down the road if you are able to wait long enough until your name comes up to the top of the list. What I was told some months ago, that it's usually 2 weeks for a woman to get into a shelter and 6 weeks for a man. And you were then were able to get into shelter for a month at the Paul Lee Loft, by the which they mean sleep there that night and then leave in the morning and come back and do that for the next 29 nights. And it's not that that isn't a service for some people that's good, but there are 46 beds there. 46 beds for 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people. And the rest are criminals. Now, in order to get around this obvious contradiction, the city attorney has said, well, you don't have to actually be in a bed. You can just be on the waiting list to be in the bed, and that'll be enough once we've gone through this undignified and abusive ticketing procedure to have your ticket dismissed. And the city attorney will do that if she or he, I'm not sure who's covering it in the city attorney's office, I think it's a she, finds your name on a waiting list. But so far, as far as I'm told by Casey Goodlevin, there has only been, I think he said 46 or 48 citations dismissed out of, we're thinking there are about 60 a month for the last 4 months, out of about around, what, anywhere between 150 to 250 citations. Now, that may mean that people aren't signing up for this waiting list. Some people don't like to do business with these bureaucrats. Some people have been expelled from the homeless service center. Others find they go over there and they can't get on the waiting list. And a lot of people don't know about it, in spite of the fact that HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, has been advising people about the existence of this waiting list. So these are the five reasons that we are having a protest with speakers, a rally, possibly a march, and a discussion as to what's the next step in dealing with the city's criminalization of the homeless policy. Again, supporting those who have already stood up for human rights, the Peace Camp 2010 activists. Secondly, drawing the community's attention to the fact that the Armory is now closed, essentially throwing out 75 to 100 people out on the streets, leaving only 46 in the Paul Lee Loft program. Third, setting up a discussion of what's next. What should we do, Coonertyville, a tent city, a 2011 peace camp? What should be our next move? Fourth, a march to the city attorney's office, because he's getting huge amounts of funding. Instead of funding going into shelter services or other necessary homeless and poverty problems, you're getting police activity to repress homeless people who are asserting basic human needs. And then fourth, some sort of action around this waiting list situation to make sure that people, we're talking about a march to the homeless service center, to get people signed up on the waiting lists if that's what the homeless service center is actually doing with people, and there have been contradictory reports, and make sure that, encourage people to try to use the tiny escape valves that exist so that people can have, after they have, as I said, had their dignity violated and essentially suffered a form of low-intensity terror at night from the police department for doing what all of us need to do, which is to sleep, that they can find some way of dismissing the legal consequences. And in a way, people should be aware that even if they don't get on Monica Martinez's waiting list, she's the executive director of the Homeless Service Center, who still declines to return emails. Well, let's put it this way. I haven't emailed her again, but I'm still waiting for a response to one I sent 2 or 3 months ago, and, of course, not getting it. Somewhat similar to Ryan Coonerty's failure as a public official to meet his responsibilities to address issues, even if addressing an issue means I'm not going to talk to you or, you know, I'm breaking my word, but I've got my reasons for it. He's claiming he's canceling his appointments with me because there's a lawsuit against the city, which might make sense, except the time he made the appointment for the previous 8 years, throughout the last eight mayors, I should say the last 8 years of three mayors, actually it was the last eight mayors, we get a new mayor every year, that none of those mayors canceled appointments that they made with me when I interviewed them for Free Radio Santa Cruz to get their opinion, to get their position on these issues, which I think is important for the community to know. Sloppy and politically motivated and shallow, superficial as their positions may be, or in some cases, who knows, pertinent as their positions may be, though that's, I generally found, not the case. Other mayors haven't tried to use that excuse. Coonerty is a kind of someone who seems deeply entrenched in the political machinations that have nothing to do with open communication, open accessibility in politics. And I've talked about this mayor and his behavior as a city council member before. It continues to be a problem. We've also, and I played this last Sunday, the American Civil Liberties Union board locally is, of course, hopeless. And probably the less said about that, the better. But activist Bob LaMonica is continuing to try to communicate with them. I intend to post my latest letter to them, not because it's worth a lot of time and energy, but because it simply documents the fact that whereas some ACLUs, like those in Berkeley, like those in Los Angeles, probably like those in Orlando, Florida, actually defend homeless civil rights, Santa Cruz is not only doesn't defend it legally, but they won't even issue press releases, public statements, speak at city council meetings about these issues, with very rare exceptions. And as I said before, I myself was arrested by the head of the board, Mayor Mike Rutkin, when I walked into an ACLU meeting in 2007 with a sign and the sleeping ban. And he said, you can't have that sign in this open meeting, which where other people were hanging out, and it was sort of a half-outdoors, half-indoors meeting. And I said, I guess you better arrest me. And he tried to, and the police wouldn't do it because they said it violated my civil liberties. The sad thing was that no ACLU member, not one, raised his voice in my defense. And there were 75 to 100 people, I don't know, 50 to 100 people there. It's a really sad example, kind of taking their lead from Mike Rutkin, who is still, he's now the treasurer of the American Civil Liberties Union, or so he was last Tuesday, when I, Steve Plaich, and Bob LaMonica, actually it was the Tuesday before last, went to the ACLU Board of Directors meeting. Bob is now on a crusade to get police funding for the DIY parade coming up this New Year's. I never like it when the police are funded particularly, because I think that just encourages them to essentially present more of a force that frightens rather than protects the community. And I think that's especially true, would be especially true, at the DIY parade time, because the DIY parade does not need any police. They've taken care of themselves just fine. That's the parade that happens every December 31st, or has for the last 6 years. And they've walked up down the street with kids and balloons and folks in costume dancing and singing. They act essentially as their own monitors. They don't even have monitors. It's just a community event that people respect, except for those in power who want to demand permits and authority and want people to recognize essentially their little badges and their power in the situation. It has nothing to do with real community needs. They are superfluous to it, except that they can frighten people by using the city attorney, who gets paid $225,000 if he goes overtime. I think it's more than $225,000. I have to recheck that, and I'll hopefully be playing that a segment from that tape on Sunday. The issue of whether Bob LaMonica is a guy who believes that he has a lot of respect for the police department, he has a lot of respect for kind of doing things in an orderly way. I think people can create their own order, and I think the police tend to create a disorder, as Mayor Daley put it in 1968. The police are not here to... the police are here to enforce disorder, is what he fumbled out and said. And he, of course, was right, although he didn't mean to say that. The disorder that they enforce is a form of rigid fear, which is a kind of disorder in the community. It looks symmetrical and military, but it's not real order. It is an imposed, fear-created order. and it's not something that I respect, approve of, or wish to fund, and I don't like that. I didn't really vote for that, although I respected that what Bob wanted to do was make sure that the police department doesn't attempt to again reduce the size of the DIY parade by threatening to ticket people who walk in it. That's what they did in December 31st of last year through Kathy Agnone, through other individuals who were involved in that process, and I believe it was Kathy Agnone. If I'm wrong, my apologies to her, but I think that she was one of the people involved in that whole thing. Staffers with the city, Deputy Chief Steve Clark, others, then Mayor Mike Rotkin, subsequently, actually it was Coonerty, but Rotkin was the mayor previously, and he made essentially threats denouncing DIY parade people for not having a permit. And it seems to me that giving money to the police is kind of equivalent to getting a permit. And I think it's also costly. I'd like to see $30,000 expended on musicians so that they get some money for the evening for being there. I wouldn't mind that. But to have to pay a bunch of stormtroopers to march up and down Pacific Avenue under the pretext that they're necessary for a friendly family event that has had no problems other than repression from those same police and prosecution agencies is ridiculous. I mean, it really is. It's a strange fantasy based upon those who need the police to feel secure. And I'm afraid Bob may be in that position. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe he's simply trying to find a way to make sure the police don't harass them by paying them off, or in essence by saying, you know, they may not have a permit, but the streets are closed and the police are being paid to be there, so they in essence do have a permit even if they don't apply for it. And I got to say, in all candor, when I've talked to at least one other activist on this issue, he was very supportive of Bob's initiative. I'm not, but that doesn't mean I don't recognize his motivations in doing it. Bob is also going to the Downtown Association on Tuesday, 9:40 in the morning, at their downtown headquarters. I think they're at 503 Pacific. He's asked me not to come because he somehow feels I will be disruptive to his intention. I wouldn't be. I'd just be there as a supporter of him as a person and an initiative, and also as a curious observer to see how the Downtown Association, which has come up with such great plans as panhandling meters and sculptures of little penguins to remove public space by establishing 14-foot forbidden zones that where you can't sit around each statue, what their latest caper is. I mean, I think groups that use as much of the public space and resources as the Downtown Association does need to be closely watched by the community. So I would suggest people want to go to that thing, they should check it out. You may be excluded. It's not clear what Chip, the executive director of the Downtown Association, will do. And I've been told by the previous director that these meetings, the board of directors meetings, are open to the public. Now, they may be changing their story as frequently as the Parks and Rec Department changes its story when it talks about sound amplification permits. That was the subject of our next discussion, which was we had a meeting at 12:30 yesterday at the Sub Rosa on the issue of street performers. And, you know, what do you do if you've got a battery-operated keyboard and you want to play as street performers with battery-operated keyboards have always done in front of New Leaf Market or at other places in the rapidly shrinking legal places that you're allowed to set up what's called a display device, which is not a large billboard, but a little table or a hat or anything which is, quote, capable of holding tangible things. That's a political table. That's a panhandler with a hat. That's a street performer with an open guitar case. Those are all subject to the restrictions of the display device ordinance, and so there's a limited number of places you can set up. Now, the Parks and Rec Department is telling people they can only set up in three places. One of them is Pearl Alley off Pacific Avenue, and the other two are in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. That was the area where I was convicted of singing a song a year ago. And in front of the Cinema 9 across the street from the Cinema 9 in front of O'Neill's sports area. So we were discussing what can be done about this issue. I think what I need to do is postpone a discussion of that because we've only got a couple minutes left here. And I will be talking about that on Sunday, assuming that I'm still in the area and haven't been persuaded to decamp to a friendlier area or maybe a cooler area. Things seem to be getting a little warm in town. And I will be happy to...
I hear there's a house opening up in Felton.
Then the voice you hear is that of Uncle Dennis, who...
It's a fixer-upper, but...
Just arrived in the studio to...
Move right in, Bob.
To talk about Jack Smith's... the vigilante group that drove Jack Smith... Actually, they're trying to drive Jack Smith out of his house. There was an injunction issued yesterday. Jack Smith was in the studio. We talked with him last time. I guess it was last Thursday. And I had hoped to have his partner, Angel, in the studio. I suspect after that court decision, they were kind of seriously depressed and didn't come in. I may have a Crystal Terrace person coming in on Sunday, as well as a critic of the Crystal Terrace. Is actually from a family that I know personally, a woman who is very articulate and says, and I kind of believe her, that she's not, is nothing against homeless people, but she's got a lot against what's going on at this Crystal Terrace house. So we can talk about that issue if we can get people rounded up, which is always problematic. I thank you for spending time with me on the stream, if you have been. This is Uncle Dennis here will surely be giving you the update on whether we'll be back on the air one of these days.
I don't know.
He doesn't know. But one,
I keep checking to see if the DSL is up over the transmitter site, but not yet.
But presumably that should happen
someday.
One of these decades.
Go picket AT&T.
There you are. Now that's a possibility for all you folks out there. Anyway, until
it's
then...
the concrete building right behind the Civic Center.
You know, in the meantime, you can listen to us on the stream. We are streaming. And, you know, I mean, it's...
Our screaming streamer.
We are cool, man. We are the screamers, and we are the streamers of tomorrow and today. And so I guess that's about it from this neck of the woods.
You got another minute, Robert. You might as well just...
I'm going to have to give you a little free time, Dennis. You haven't been given your true due, as we say, or perhaps your true doo-doo. In any case, you need to kind of... I'm going to pass this on to you and let you deal with the dead air, or perhaps I will babble a bit.
We don't have dead air, Robert.
You have dead stream.
Dead stream.
Dead fish in the stream.
That's the San Lorenzo, isn't it?
You would know that better than I. I do not have...
There ain't a whole lot of fish in it.
It's a fishy, or perhaps not as fishy, a situation as it might be.
Well, fishy season is coming up.
So, again, if you want to be involved with Huff or with this protest, you don't know what's cooking, and you want to know, call Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833. And I'll be, if not there, answering phone calls later, so we can do it then. Until then, you're stuck with From the Cream to the Dregs, which is Uncle Dennis, who is coming here to regale you with the latest in, or should we say the oldest, in tunes of yesteryear, or yesterdecade, if you will. Actually, some of my favorite tunes back then. Just modern music, I don't know what to say. So I'm going to leave that there, Dennis. I'd say slip a disc in and go for the gusto.
And I will get to it here.
And I will leave it there. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
We're dancing around the studio.
Oh, you're such a dancer.
Let's see. What do you want to hear? I don't know. It's things get far more impromptu. Well, let's put on some Joe Bonamassa here. Let's slide in that disc and... you're listening to www.freakradio.org, the live stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Unfortunately, as Robert said, we are not streaming. I mean, we are not broadcasting. We are only streaming. So we will get as much of that fixed as soon as we can. Let's listen to some rock and blues here from Joe Bonamassa off his album from last year, Black Rock.
All right.